सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है.
वेलकम टू सोच विचार. टुडे वी हैव विद अस डॉक्टर शाहिद यूसुफ. शाहिद यूसुफ इज अ वेरी वेल नोन नेम इन इकोनॉमिक डेवलपमेंट सर्कल्स. ही इज फ्रॉम पाकिस्तान एज द नेम suggests, as you might have guessed. But very few Pakistanis know him because Shahid seldom goes to Pakistan, much to my regret. I keep pressing him to go to Pakistan. But unfortunately, there's also not enough invitations for him to go, which is very unfortunate. But be that as it may, let me introduce Shahid Yusuf to you. As I said, Shahid Yusuf is a very well-known, well-published economist from Pakistan who spent a very long career in the World Bank. He's educated at Cambridge and Harvard. He did his PhD at Harvard. He came to the World Bank directly after his PhD and has spent something like 36 or 40 years in the World Bank. Started at a very young age and retired. And now he is the chief economist at the Growth Dialogue in George Washington University, as well as an adjunct professor in SAIS, which is the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He consults a lot with different agencies, has participated in a number of important dialogues, and is a well-known analyst for China. We will do a separate program with him in China. But today, I think it's a very important subject that we are going to discuss, which has very deep relevance for Pakistan and for development economics and development policy in general. Shahid is going to tell us about industrialization and growth, drawing upon many references and thoughts from major thinkers and his own thoughts. Shahid, welcome to Soch Pichar.
Thank you, Nitim, and thank you for the very generous introduction.
Shahid, let me ask you very briefly, what do you still think is important for industrialization and growth in the age of the internet? And why would you still say that every country should have an industrialization policy?
The reason I attach importance to industrialization is that when I look at the experience of all of the successful developing economies and those that have risen into the ranks of upper middle income countries or even into the ranks of the high income countries, you note that all of them did so by dint of industrialization, in particular the development of manufacturing capacity, and in every case also manufacturing capabilities that were translated into exports or created exports that provided the principal engine of growth for long periods of time. Now, we are looking at a somewhat different type of situation where industrialization is not really the engine that it used to be. And so the question that comes to mind is, are we entering into an era when the lower middle and low income countries will have to look for other ways, other engines of growth? And if so, what would they be? So I think the way we might address this is first to look at, you know, what is happening to the industrialization process in lower middle and even in upper middle income countries. And secondly, what the implications are for a country such as Pakistan or other South Asian economies.
But Shahid, tell me, you still think that it is a very, that industrialization is a very important path to a country's progress to a high upper middle income country or a higher income country?
Yes.
And the reason being that let's think in terms of model. What would your model be? Is it because it'll lead to more exports? Is it because it'll lead to more skill development? Is it because it'll lead to more capital formation? Which aspect of it are you emphasizing?
I think there are three which I would emphasize. Firstly, the manufacturing sector is the one that has been in the lead when it comes to technological change, and it has also been in the lead when it comes to gains in productivity. And as you know, I mean, if incomes are, real incomes are going to rise, then they are going to be, it is going to be because productivity is rising also. The second thing is that it's the manufacturing sector which has generally been at the forefront of countries' export drive. Virtually no country, and in fact, I would say virtually no country has been successful in promoting export-led growth in the absence of a very competitive manufacturing sector. And the last point is that the manufacturing sector was the one that actually absorbed a substantial volume of the workers who came out of the rural sector. If you look at the, for instance, the economy of the United Kingdom, when it peaked, when manufacturing peaked in actually just before the First World War, almost 45% of the workforce was employed in that sector. Even in the United States, when manufacturing peaked in the late 70s, something like a quarter of the workforce was employed there. And the important thing here is not just that large numbers of people were employed by manufacturing, but also that manufacturing provided some of the better paid jobs for blue collar workers and also workers with more skills. And therefore, it was critical to the creation of a middle class in all of the currently industrialized and advanced countries, and also important for creation of the middle class in a country like Korea or in an economy such as Taiwan. Even today, when I think of China, I see manufacturing development as being just as important for the creation of a large and relatively affluent Chinese middle class.
Shahid, I mean, you laid it out very nicely, but there are a number of questions that arise there. One is, for example, you give examples of the industrial countries, especially the UK, the US, and European countries, which at the turn of the century, or maybe even towards the Second World War, manufacturing was booming and it was a peak. And yes, of course, the middle class was formed on the basis of manufacturing jobs, and these were very nice industrial jobs that people had a very nice life out of. But as you see now, the debate in the US for the last at least 7, 8, maybe 10 years has been the decline of manufacturing and how the middle class is now crumbling because those jobs are no longer available. So could it be that this was an historical era and it has passed, that there was the assembly line, and the assembly line required a large number of people, the famous Detroit factory of Ford, which employed how many thousand people and was settled on maybe a few square miles. That kind of a factory is now gone, and that kind of industrial structure is gone. Do you think it's replicable in a poor country? Is that a model that we should still strive for?
Well, you see, countries, lower and lower middle income countries, even the high income countries such as the United States, have not given up their hope in manufacturing, even though, as you rightly point out, the era of the large assembly line, the huge factories which existed about 50, 60 years ago, all of those have sort of passed into history. But the fact remains that, as I say, that country like Ethiopia, country like Pakistan, country like India, which says "Make in India now" is the clarion call from Mr. Modi. All of them are hoping somehow that they can rev up the manufacturing engine and ride up into the ranks of higher income countries. Mm-hmm. Now, is that possible? For some of the African countries, the lower income countries, even including a country like Pakistan or Bangladesh, the expectation is that a lot of labor-intensive activities from garments, footwear, light consumer, electricals, and so forth, that these will migrate from Southeast Asian countries and China to the African countries and South Asian countries, which are still in the sort of lower middle income or lower income category. And that they will provide the same kind of springboard that they did for these Southeast Asian and countries and for China and Korea. Is that likely? Possibly not. And the reason is, again, technological change, which is reducing the importance of low-cost, semi-skilled or unskilled workers. Second category is there some other kind of industry that could flourish in this kind of a situation? The expectation of lower and lower middle income countries is that there will be a transfer of certain kinds of labor intensive activities from Southeast Asia and China to these countries, and that these will then provide the kind of springboard for development as they did earlier on for countries in East Asia. The question, as I say, is suppose this does not materialize, this kind of transfer does not occur, because these types of labor-intensive activities are also going through a technological revolution, and they are becoming far more capital, skill, and technology-intensive. So the challenge for the lower-income, lower-middle-income countries is, can they still rely on some other types of manufacturing activities to boost their developmental chances?
But then, Shahid, there's another issue that I'd like to raise with you, arising exactly out of what you said. You know, you talked about, for example, the rural-urban migration, which has been a preoccupation of development economics, and that it has always been linked with manufacturing, that there will be migration from low-productivity rural work to high-productivity manufacturing work in the urban areas. And now you're saying that, and of course, there was also the expectation that this would be labor intensive because of the fact that you had these large assembly line manufacturing outfits. But now, as you point out, technology has changed and that may not be a possibility. Similarly, as you said, that in terms of the Pakistan has, for example, a huge expectation that manufacturing from China will come towards Pakistan. But as you rightly point out, that technological change is happening and this may not happen. So let me ask you a question. It seems to me that even this migration or even this sort of moving towards manufacturing is besotted with two different risks. One is the risk of changing technology. The second risk that I'd point out is quite likely is that I think it can be argued that the terms of trade of manufacturing have been declining over the last century. Just like the previous century saw the terms of trade of agriculture declining, would I be right in saying that the terms of trade for manufacturing, just pure manufacturing, have also been declining, that the manufacturing margins and standard products have been declining, as is witnessed by Walmart, which is putting out all kinds of cheap manufactured goods at a very, very cheap price. So countries that are dreaming of migration, what kind of a risk are they taking, and how do they guard against those risks?
Well, as you said, one of the reasons why the share of manufacturing in GDP is on a decline is because the terms of trade are turning against manufacturing and in relative to services. And therefore, because of this shift in relative prices, this is one of the reasons why manufacturing, the value of manufacturing in GDP is less, even though in volume terms, the volume of manufacturing continues to rise. Now, assuming that that's what is happening, it's going on side by side with a decline in the share of employment in manufacturing. If you look at the case of, let's say, India, you see over a period of the last 10 years that not only has the share of manufacturing in India's GDP come down, so also has the share of employment. And the result is that employment in the formal sector is, I think, a very modest 11 or 12% of the total Indian formal workforce. And that's nothing. And the trend is clearly downwards. Likewise, in the case of Pakistan, if I go by the numbers the World Bank publishes, the share of manufacturing has gone from roughly 16% to 14%. And I would assume that the share in employment is probably somewhere in the 11 to 12% range.
Yeah, it's declining.
Okay, so it declined. And to me, it seems that once you are on this kind of a skid, that the likelihood of reversing it is really very small. And to hope that somehow a large chunk of Chinese manufacturing will transfer to Pakistan and to Ethiopia and to Kenya and all these other countries that are sort of longingly looking towards China to do so seems increasingly implausible. And the reason is that the Chinese are moving much more rapidly than most other countries in mechanizing their industrial system. And this mechanizing is going on in garment manufacturing, in footwear, in electronic assembly, in auto assembly, everywhere you look. They're moving very rapidly. They are now the largest purchasers of robots in the world. So my sense is, and by the way, employment in Chinese manufacturing is either stable or on a slow decline. And roughly 79 million people out of a vast labor force are now currently employed in formal manufacturing.
So what percentage of manufacturing would that be in China?
Manufacturing's share of GDP in China is about 30 to 31%.
Okay.
Hmm. And it's kind of roughly been stable at that level for the last few years. Total employment in all kinds of manufacturing, which includes township and village enterprises, is around 104, 105 million people altogether. So, you know, it's a relatively small part of the workforce. Mm-hmm. And there's no likelihood of it growing, and there's every likelihood of it shrinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, if there is some transfer, yes, there may be some in garments and footwear and such like. Unfortunately, it's not going to be terribly helpful for a country like, say, Pakistan or Ethiopia or Kenya. And the reason being that what will transfer will be relatively low value adding jobs in manufacturing, which are not likely to see substantial gains in productivity, which are not likely to see substantial gains in technological change. And the consequence is, so you'll have a shift of certain kinds of dead end, sort of low value adding commodity type industries to these countries. We're already there and it's not helping a lot.
So then Shahid, in a sense, you brought me back full circle.
Yeah.
You started off by giving me hope that there was a clear direction for policy, which was to seek manufacturing or industrialization as a path to growth. And now when we discuss the details, you tell me that it is going to be very risky given the fact that A, technology is moving against us, B, terms of trade are moving against us, C, the industrialized countries like China or the Southeast Asia may be making more technology gains, and therefore countries like Pakistan or the poor countries may not be able to catch up in man. Then what should we do? What is the policy message that you want to give?
Okay, you see, I started off by saying that in the past, the manufacturing has been the leading sector and the principal driver of growth in successful economies. What I see now, and I think I tend to sort of agree with Danny Roderick, that we are seeing premature deindustrialization in a number of countries. I think a different path will have to be chalked out. Now, the problem with chalking out this different path is you have to look at what the other two sectors might provide. One is services, which is generally the largest sector in every economy. The other is agriculture, which tends to be a shrinking sector in virtually every country, though in the low-income countries, the rate at which it is shrinking is kind of slow. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, let's look at services. Everybody attaches a lot of importance to services as a source of employment, as a source of growth, potentially because of ICT as a as even a driver of some kind of technological change. Technological change which benefits from the diffusion of ICT. The problem here is as follows. Many services, many of the most productive services, banking, insurance, engineering services, architectural and design services, R&D services, most of these are sort of intermediate products. These were generally products or services, if I call them, that are sold to manufacturers. Mm-hmm. Manufacturers bought these services because they needed them in order to add value to their product. They needed design services, they needed R&D, they needed banking, they needed all these things in order to be able to produce manufacturers and to sell them. Now, if you start out with a fairly dynamic, large and growing manufacturing sector as Korea did, as China has, as all the advanced countries have, then this provided a certain sort of demand pull for a lot of the most productive services, business services. Mm-hmm. And these most productive business services are the ones that have been most effective in utilizing ICT to enhance their own productivity. Mm-hmm. Okay, so manufacturing, as I see it, has been really important for the development of a thriving and dynamic services sector and giving the advanced countries a sort of a flying start in finding an alternative engine of growth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, suppose you have a situation, as let's say in Pakistan, where the manufacturing sector is small and has relatively low value added. Has generally, it's not a dynamic sector in that it's not doing much by way of R&D. It is not, blazing new trails in design. It's not adding a lot of value from sort of services that really matter. And suppose it's also a shrinking sector of the economy. Mm-hmm. How then do you develop the sort of tradable, dynamic, value-adding services? Mm-hmm. I think that's really, to me, the most severe challenge, because I don't see an alternative to tradable business services as a source of growth for a place like Pakistan or India or others. I don't see an alternative. But at the same time, what is going to ignite this process of development of high value adding tradable services? I think that's where a lot of the attention needs to be focused, because without it, I don't think we'll get anywhere.
Shahid, your model, basically, if I accept your model, what your model is saying is that manufacturing is the driver of the economy in many ways. For example, it is a driver that sort of drives globalization for a start. B, it is a driver that generates the products that can be put out in a globalized market. C, it is the product. It is the driver of services because it demands services. Right. At the same time, it is the processor of agricultural commodities. So manufacturing, in some sense, is central to economic activity.
Yeah.
And therefore, it has to be, encouraged.
Yeah.
But let me now look at the policies to encourage manufacturing. I mean, I would argue, and you can, take objection to it, because you know Pakistan well. I would argue that in Pakistan, from day one, we have been trying to encourage manufacturing. We've tried everything under the sun. We've given them protection. We've given them subsidies. We've given them exchange rate advantages in terms of, if you remember, the dual exchange rate regime that we had. We've given them licensing advantages. We've given them bank credit advantages. We've given them export financing advantages. But yet, as you say, we've got a lackluster manufacturing sector, which is low productivity, which is generating low margin items. So what is it that we've done wrong? We've made industrial estates for them. We've given them cheap energy. We protect. What else can we do?
All of the various East Asian countries, including China, started out with what I would say fairly protected light manufacturing activities. China was a bit different, but it also developed a lot of capital intensive industries at the same time, many of them highly inefficient and scattered around the country. Now, at some point, particularly with the use of exchange rate policy and with a lot of push from the government and with the help of foreign direct investment in the case of at least Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, and China, these countries hooked on to global value chains and started actively pursuing export markets. I think Pakistan never did that.
So where would you think the difference came about?
I think if you look at when Korea's exports took off or China's exports took off, you find that it happened soon after a major devaluation. And in each case, and particularly in the case of China and particularly in the case of Korea, from a lot of pressure from the government on businesses to export or lose the incentives that they were being given, incentives through credit policies, you know, wastage allowances and all these things that Korea, for example, provided. It was a dual thing. One was the carrot, which was that you had a really advantageous exchange rate plus numerous other incentives. And the stick was, if you didn't perform, you were going to be in difficulty because the government would be pulling the rug from underneath you.
You're pointing out two things. Undervaluation is important, that the exchange rate must be undervalued. We should not have an exchange rate that seeks to protect imports. And the second thing that you're saying is that the policy should be clever enough, and I emphasize clever enough to monitor these people and then monitor the manufacturers and in terms of what they're exporting, and really be able to penalize those who are not able to export. What about lobbying? Because what we see in Pakistan is once an industry comes into place, develops some capital, then it is able to lobby perpetuation of subsidy to itself.
Right. Let me also emphasize a third prong, which was that, you know, in the case of several, but not by any means all of the export industries in East Asia, the foreign direct investment was really quite important, not only in transferring technology and providing capital, but also providing access to international markets and to international buyers. Now, Pakistan has attracted very, very little of such types of investment. So I think that's one kind of problem. The second thing that you mentioned here is this whole business of lobbying. That is, once an industry is established, it starts beating the path to the government office in order to ensure that its subsidies and protection is perpetuated. Now, I think here the example of let's take the case of a Korea is quite instructive. Korea has, as you well know, and has had for a while, some very large and very powerful conglomerates. These conglomerates, all privately owned, have been the driving force of Korea's development. And they certainly have had the economic potential and the economic power to influence the government. The difference is that you had authoritarian governments in a Korea, and you have had them in Pakistan as well, that were able to resist the pressure from these groups and to ensure that they remained outwardly focused and that they made every effort to be competitive through a variety of channels. So the Korean state was not co-opted by these conglomerates. Likewise,
that's fascinating. You're saying that the well-known huge companies like Samsung, like LG, like Hyundai, like Kia, these companies are unable to influence policy in Korea. Now, why is that?
Okay. If you look at the period of Korea's most rapid growth through roughly 1988, you find that there was plenty of corruption in Korea. One can't say that it's kind of a squeaky clean country. That would be highly unusual. But the fact remains that as far as the export-oriented growth focus was concerned, the government was able to hold the industrialists' feet to the fire with the threat of withdrawing the subsidies and other incentives it provided, and taking up, you know, all sorts of using other instruments like the tax system to make sure that they remained focused on exports. Mm-hmm. So the fact of the matter was that that authoritarian military government, which lasted out to roughly 1987-88, was able to do this. It had the autonomy and the authority to be able to do this.
But it is unusual, isn't it? Because most military governments are easily co-opted because they lack legitimacy to be able to take on the industrial conglomerates.
Well, I don't know. Let's look at the three cases which come to mind if you include Singapore, there's a fourth case, so that's not a military government. But, you know, if you look at Taiwan, Korea, and Brazil, for example, Brazil during its high growth period from roughly 1965 to about 1978, was a military government. Chile, again, during its high growth period under Pinochet, was a military government. So you have at least four or five cases where you have military government that was able to create a developmental state and ensure that its industries evolved in a way in which they were competitive and export-oriented.
Shahid, I hope you're not arguing against democracy.
Not at all.
That would really label us in a very bad position.
Not at all. But I'm just pointing out that, you know, of course, as we all know, there are numerous instances of military governments or other authoritarian regimes that have been highly unsuccessful in this regard. And we also have the case of another very authoritarian regime in China, which again has been very successful and which has influenced thinking in many other developing countries.
Mm-hmm. Shahid, let me ask you another question. Based on all what you're saying, I kind of agree with what you're saying, but I still have a certain reservations, let me put it this way. Let me think about it, that if we are trying to push for industrial policy, I see some risks ahead of us. One is the risk that the technology keep changing rapidly, and the whole process of technology transfer that these countries engage in is trying to freeze technology at a certain point in time, but the technology escapes from them. Case in point being the car industry. We tried to make a car industry in Pakistan, we tried to freeze the technology of the 80s, and now technologies escape way beyond us, from to hybrid cars, to electric cars, to all kinds of other cars that we can't seem to keep up with. We are still manufacturing the cars of the 80s. So one is we may get stuck in the technological thing. The other is, of course, the lobbying argument. And the third thing is that, unfortunately, no matter what we do, the undervaluation policy will not stick for political reasons. So I think I can see many pitfalls there. I can't seem to devise a policy for industrialization. Can you make me think of a way, for example, as I told you, this program is dedicated or directed more towards kids, researchers, thinkers of economics. How should they think of these issues in terms of the research projects? Where should they begin to investigate to make a case for the kind of argument that you're making?
Well, you know, if you think of the auto industry, for example, I mean, it's the industry with arguably the largest multipliers in terms of other activities that it triggers and to which it is linked. One country which developed its own indigenous auto industry, and there are not many that have been able to do so more or less independently, was Korea. It started out with some foreign direct investment in the auto industry, and the auto industry was highly protected. But at some point, a decision was made by actually the CEOs of Hyundai that they were going to develop the technology indigenously, and they devoted themselves to trying to do so with the minimum of foreign assistance and the minimum of foreign parts being utilized in their automobile. Now, they received protection from the government, they received support from the government, and they went through scores and scores of prototypes. But ultimately, they were successful in developing a largely indigenous auto industry. Interestingly, China has been trying to do something similar and has not been very successful, in large part because it has become really dependent upon foreign investors in their auto industry. And the auto industry continues to be dominated by foreign investors. And this has, in a sense, deterred R&D and development of core technologies in the auto industry in China. So my point here is as follows. I think the auto industry is probably well beyond a capability of a Pakistan. The question then is, which industries with substantial linkage effects, with substantial linkages to services activities that are going to be the principal employers and probably the principal sort of growth drivers over the longer term, which industries could we usefully try and nurture in the Pakistani context? Now, agro-technology and agro-businesses is one of them. It's well known. It has its. It can create its own innovation system that can support technology development and so on. And it's a very stable industry, and it's an industry that will always have a market somewhere because food supplies are going to be, you know, under threat as climate changes over the longer term. So I think here is one industry which has a lot of technology associated with it, which Pakistan seems to have a revealed comparative advantage in, which could be the basis for an innovation system, or at least a dedicated innovation system, which we could try and develop. Other industries that...
But Chad, aren't we coming dangerously close to sector picking?
Oh, sure.
In the 90s, we were warned against sector picking, or industry picking, that it's not good for... policy advisors to pick sectors or give advice on where to invest.
Yeah. Well, yes, we were told never to pick winners because many countries that did pick winners failed, whereas some countries that picked winners, like all the East Asian countries, actually succeeded. If you take a China, it's been picking winners since day one. It's been deciding exactly what it wants to do, and it continues to pick winners. So likewise, when you look at these growth diagnostic techniques that we use, the so-called Hausmann, Hidalgo, Klinger, Roderick type of stuff, if you look at it, what is it? It's just about picking winners. It gives you extremely detailed 3- and 4-digit level ideas as to which industries should be pursued. Now, if we're going to have an industrial policy, one can continue with a sort of, what you call a horizontal policy, which provides assistance for technology development, training, infrastructure, special economic zones, and we've done all of that. I think it's probably necessary to go the extra step and actually put one's bets on some industries. Britain is thinking about that. The European countries are thinking about it. Everybody's thinking about it. The times have changed.
So you're saying we still can do that. Let me ask you another question. FDI, you've emphasized.
Yeah.
Now, I have, ever since I don't know when, I have not seen any one of our leaders who has not laid out a red carpet for foreign direct investment. I mean, there are pictures in newspapers every few days of the Prime Minister, the President, or the dictator of the day sitting with some foreign investor and running to China and running to US and UK, etc., etc., looking for foreign investors. We have tried our best to attract foreign investors. Nobody wants to come. Number two, the investors who come, they come with so many concessions that I don't know whether it's even worth bringing them in. For example, case in point, we were trying to attract investors into Thar Coal, and you're giving them God knows 100 years of tax-free advantage and this, that, etc. By the end of it, I don't know what we were gaining. So what is it that we are doing wrong, that we give all kinds of incentives, we treat, give them the red carpet, our prime minister and president greet them, and they don't want to come to us, and when they come to us, they don't leave much productivity or gains behind. Whereas you said China and Korea, etc., at work. So what's the difference?
Well, again, I mean, let's look at a kind of a comparable country, which is Vietnam, being very successful now in attracting foreign direct investment, not only from China, but from other East Asian countries, European countries. And, you know, when I worked on Vietnam and I'm sort of vaguely compared it with Pakistan, it's not, I mean, it has a population of whatever, close to 90 million and so on. So it's not too unlike Pakistan in terms of level of development. But it seems to have attracted enough, plentiful, in fact, foreign direct investment. So what I think Pakistan lacks in spades is this attractive investment climate. Mm-hmm. As even a casual visitor who lands at Karachi airport, drives into the city, can observe, the infrastructure is dilapidated. Mm-hmm. The city is distinctly uninviting for foreigners. Our security system situation is, I think, constantly deteriorating. So I would say that given the options available to most foreign investors, and given how sort of skittish they are about in putting their money down, as you know, there's a huge amount of capital out there which is just sitting idle. So there's not an excess of eagerness on the part of multinationals to put investment down in any country. And if they do, they're looking for countries that promise them return over the long term with the minimum of uncertainty. And a place like Vietnam, for example, is offering that sort of long-term developmental prospects, as well as it's a neighbor of China, so Chinese can move some of the investment there, and people investing in Vietnam know that they would be able perhaps to sell in China or sell in East Asia. So the neighborhood effect is very, very promising for Vietnam. In addition, the internal domestic situation and the sort of policy signals they get from the government also embolden investors to put their money into industries in Vietnam. I think we don't have that. I think the country is very, very uninviting for a foreign investor in many ways. Mm-hmm. And one only has to compare with, let's say, a Thailand or a Vietnam in detail to figure out what's missing in Pakistan. It's not the fiscal and financial incentives. It's
fascinating. Other. But Shahid, let me raise another question with you then, going towards coming to a further conclusion. The brunt of what you're saying, I accept, that we need to move towards high value added, globalized production, fitting into the global value chain, and trying to seek a place for ourselves in the global value chain where we can offer something to the globe and be able to interact with the globe and gain from whatever advantages we can derive in the global value chain. The policies, the directions that you point to are undervaluation of the exchange rate, a very clever approach to managing industry, as well as a very clever approach to managing FDI, being able to research and understand where things are going. I would argue this requires a very, very informed, innovative, creative government that can manage such a difficult task, being able to look at the research of Roderick Hausmann, etc., understand it, imbibe it, take it into policy. Does that not presuppose that we have to have a governance reform before we can even think about it?
Well, you know, a governance reform of a thoroughgoing sort may be a bridge too far for, let's say, a place like Pakistan. Let me give you an example of Ireland. And Ireland in the 1980s was a pretty corrupt, pretty dismal kind of place. It was not growing, it was a sort of sliding backwards, it was caught in some sort of morass. They then created, first they had, they joined the EU, so they got the structured funds. Secondly, they set up what was one of the more effective economic development agencies in the world. And what this agency did with the backing of the government was that it went out and it attracted, firstly, it had the capacity to identify areas where Ireland had a comparative advantage in which it could develop. And secondly,
Shahid, when you say had the capacity, does that not mean the ability to be able to research, understand, engage in the global debate and pick from it as to where you want to go, find the evidence to understand where you are, analyze that evidence?
Yes, yes, it is. It's true. But what the point I'm making is that you can have such capacity in a government. It doesn't have to be hundreds of people. It probably is a few score people. But the government has to be committed. One, and all of the governments that have succeeded have committed themselves to developing the country. They have created generally...
committed and receptive to this.
Yes, and they've created fairly small agencies which were highly technocratic and that were able to push the development and industrialization agenda effectively, not only within the country, but outside the country as well. So
my final question would be, why do we have to think in terms of sectors, either manufacturing, services, or agriculture? If we think purely of, let's say, developing entrepreneurship, innovation, like Modi yesterday put out a whole new policy on startup culture, right? If we can think of a framework where we put entrepreneurship and innovation first, right, and let that entrepreneurship and innovation decide which direction the economy moves in, which sector it moves towards, so long as they are able to fit themselves into the global value chain and be able to fit themselves into the global skill chain and be able to maximize exports or whatever out of the global value chain. Would that policy not be better than just trying to push an industrial policy? I mean, this policy would be much more based on fitting ourselves into a global value chain, a global skill chain, and through entrepreneurship and innovation.
You know, I think if one just approaches it from the side of, you know, entrepreneurship and developing an innovation system, I think that would take a very long time. I would say that the policy has to have both a focus on innovation and perhaps development of entrepreneurship and a startup culture, but at the same time, a complementary focus on specific or particular subsectors that seem very promising. I don't think it should be either or. I think we've already... and many countries have already tried this more general approach of, you know, let's try and develop an ecosystem that has all of these nice attributes of entrepreneurship, of innovativeness, and so on. And I think it takes, one, a very long time, and secondly, no one really knows how exactly to do it. But if you have some sort of concrete ideas of which industries you're going to also try and push, then I think you might get a lot of synergy between this effort to develop this innovative culture or whatever, and also to develop an industry that works for the country. I have to say one thing here, which is that, and I go back to this whole business about services and manufacturing, on average, about 30% of the value added in manufacturing these days in the United States for any industry, on average, is about 30%. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is that any policy will have to play on several registers. And two important registers will be certain kinds of business services that complement certain types of manufacturing activities. I think if you do only one or the other, I think it won't work. If you just do these two and ignore the whole process of developing a skilled workforce, of developing an innovation system and developing necessary infrastructure, you'll also not be able to get very far. So unfortunately, it has to be a fairly broad gauge approach. And I think, as you rightly pointed out, it requires a considerable amount of expertise on the part of government. But perhaps this could be done without necessarily, fixing governance root and branch, which I think is really a very, very difficult process.
No, I fully agree with you. I think it's a very interesting thought. You see, Shahid, I had a stint in the government, as you know. And what I noticed was that, unfortunately, the government has come to a point where there's very little capacity to understand this. I mean, even something like exchange rate and devaluation, if you go and mention that in the cabinet, very few people understand what it is. And they don't even have the time to understand it. So I think, whereas I agree with you that it requires, it's not as if you're building up a whole research-oriented government, but you have to put in research and thinking into various parts of the government and for the leadership to be able to understand what it is and how to deal with it. Case in point being, for example, our energy situation has been a problem, but we have not developed any research capacity to understand the energy situation. Your industrial policy is a very valid point again, but the kinds of arguments that you're making for us to imbibe them and take them into the government is a very, very difficult thing and something that we have to see. But thank you very much. I think you've given us a lot of interesting thoughts and ideas. I think students can learn a lot from this, and I can see a number of different areas for them to start thinking and doing some research, all the way from trying to understand the industrial sector, why the malaise, to understanding the various East Asian experiences, to understanding how our exchange rate policy is moving, to understand what our industrial policy is, what is the FDI policy, to contrast it with Vietnam and see what are the differences. So a number of areas that we can go on, and thank you for shedding light on them. Before we go, I want one last question, one last thought from you. Would you like to recommend a book? I know, Shahid, the one thing that I must tell people, Shahid Yusuf is one person that I turn to when I want to learn about books, because he probably reads the most amongst all the people that I know, and the people that I know read a lot anyways, but Shahid is a reader maximus, if I might put it that way. So Shahid, what book would you now, today, forget about it, or whatever, what book would you recommend to kids in Pakistan that they must read, and give us a reason why?
Well, one thing which comes to mind, given the present predicament of the country, is a book which may or may not strike the right chord, but it is this book called Startup Nation. You know of that, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's by by a couple of Israelis.
Yep.
And it's about
It's about Israel.
And it's about how it has become a hotbed of new startup activities in areas that would be perhaps of interest in Pakistan, which is, IT related or water conservation related, mm-hmm. or, other kinds of technology related, which is within Pakistan's capacity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also it brings out the extremely important role of the military in nurturing these technologies and in grooming individuals, grooming individuals and giving them the kind of skills they need in order to start up these new companies, and in the process attract a whole lot of capital from the advanced countries. So I know there are many books out there, but this one actually caught my fancy. It seems like it has some lessons for us.
I think it's a great book. Not only does it have lessons for us, but it's also a very bitter pill for us.
Yes.
I mean, it illustrates very clearly why a small country like that has got a billion Muslims kind of on the defensive. Yes. But we will not get into politics. That's not our role. Right. But I think it's a wonderful book, and I think your recommendation is well taken. Just very quickly, what do you think that book shows?
Well, one, it brings out the essential role of entrepreneurship, of the willingness to take risks. I think that's really important. I think it brings out also the role, as I said, of the military as an institution that can actually promote scientific development and scientific change. And it brings out very clearly how you know, establishing linkages with a global scientific community and the global entrepreneurial and venture capital community can help a small, somewhat isolated country to develop its capabilities.
Fascinating, fascinating. I think, Shahid, this is wonderful. I will try and prevail upon you again to help us.
Because I think this is very important. People can learn a lot from you. This discussion has been very instructive for me, at least. I've enjoyed it enormously. So, Shahid, thank you very much.
Welcome.
We'll do it again.
Surely. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.